Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hey, folks, you're listening to The Hang, hosted by the Broadway Podcast Network. This week, I chat to writers, producers, actors, directors. Yeah, they really do it all. Crash Buis and Lauren Seneschal. I only met Crash and Lauren recently when they cast me in their latest film project, but I found their creativity and work ethic so inspiring that I simply had to hang with them and find out more about their backgrounds, where they came from, and what motivates them. Please enjoy.
Corey, no, because I think I'd love to hear that. So you always worry about getting on stage and something in your nose?
In my nose, yeah. That's usually the one. So I just keep going like that. I'm like, oh man, somebody's gonna hear me sniffing back here, and they're not gonna think it's.
But isn't that weird? Because when you're on stage, you're playing a human. Well, characters don't sniff.
No, absolutely not.
No, I didn't put that in the script.
No, I'm not on stage.
Characters.
Like if I sneeze on stage, I sneeze. So if I'm in Funny Girl playing Nick Arnstein,
and you sneeze.
Nick Arnstein.
Well, Nick Arnstein like has a classy sneeze though.
You can't have a Ramin sneeze.
The Ramin sneeze wouldn't fly, but you're too in character, so.
Of course, method.
Yes, all the way.
My worry is always my fly being undone.
Yeah.
And the worst is, like, once you have it in your head, you need to check. You could be halfway through a solo. So I remember I was doing Still in Anastasia. Chest. I'm like, just, and how do you?
No,
there's
you
no way to make just, that look good. I mean.
Just kind of move so your pants stay together, and then you just walk weird.
Hand in front.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
There you go.
So, my as Park Fetch was a guy I went to grad school with, and we would go on stage one time, and it was like, I don't know, it's opening for some college show or whatever. He looks at me, he's like, check your fly and don't fuck up. And then he went on stage, and that was his good show. That was his like break a leg.
Brilliant.
I was like,
but then you're checking your fly.
Yeah, all the time on stage.
Are you kind of naughty on stage? Like, let's say we're in a scene, and then I'm like, you know, you look down your fly, it makes the other person think.
That's mean.
My fly's undone. I know it's mean.
That's mean.
I'm usually on the receiving end of that. Like someone's eyes will do that. I'm like, why are they looking over there? What's going on? Look on your shoulder.
Are you the kid who thinks that like you think that you're on the receiving end all the time, so you try to fire back, and they're like, he's always doing that. I think he thinks he's the victim here.
100% I'm on the receiving end because I am the. If I think something funny, I'll think it's funny.
Right. So that you get a yeah.
Yeah, I told you guys that story when we're shooting about. In Les Mis. I get called in the office for me and you're corpsing. I said no. Valjean is finding something funny because I'm only receiving and playing off what's happening on stage.
Yeah.
I'm not a little rat, so I'm not going to tell you what's going on.
Who was doing what? Yeah.
And to be fair, it was a gauntlet of things just to get to who am I. I'm like, would you guys just leave me alone? And that's the thing, because on shows like that, especially when you're close with some, and for me, I always find those who are probably the most talented are the most deranged as well. Yeah. And they're like, they'll smell blood. Like, oh, we see a little thing in his mouth. Let's get him. We're going to get him.
I mean, you made yourself an easy target, though.
100%. They know.
So it's like, yeah, we got to do it.
That'll be nice. It'll be nice to get to that point where I'm like, whatever. No, it made sense. Instead of going, I'm sorry. I misbehaved on stage.
There's this one moment in Love Never Dies where I had, as a phantom, sing off stage. Now, again, what did I tell you? Like, month one, everything's smooth. Month two, still integrity. Month three, people start getting a little bit bored. They look for, how can we entertain ourselves to pass the next 5 minutes?
Right.
Oh, there's Ramin singing in the wings, watching the cue. Christine, don't think that I don't. They'll be in my ear before I sing, like, instead of me getting my note, like, Christine, please, hang. What the heck? And then you, but you're live, so you just got to do it. So, and then they found, oh, we can affect them. Then they'd be around me more and more.
Oh, no.
To the point where I would be hiding somewhere behind curtains, like crouched down, hoping I'm in time, because I have to hide from these crazy friends of mine.
Sure, yeah.
At one point, they were literally taping me as I'm singing. There's a tape going around me. I'm like, we're grown-ass adults. What are we doing here?
Do you feel like at some point that, like, when you get to that, like, usually people talk about, like, doing theater performances and stuff, and it gets, like, it just gets more ingrained as you go along. It gets really deep, and you start to find new things. Do you feel like sometimes you're in a show where you're like, nah, it was better the first 2 months, because we all got used to it, and it was, especially with something so technically demanding as, like, a musical, where it's, like, it's always the same beat, it's always the same moment. You're trying to make it fresh, but it's, you have to hit these marks. Do you feel like...
I find, as time goes on, from personal experience, but also those that I vibe with on stage, even if they are having fun, most of the time they do it in character, and I think, well, that's fun. It's almost like an improv, and as far as I'm concerned, if it doesn't affect the story and only feeds life on stage that story, then that's great because you're getting a vibrance. But I think I know I can be guilty of it too, where you always want to keep it fresh. So your intentions are right, but you could be over layering it to the point where it's like, strip it back to remember what you found in the room.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're not playing to an audience who might come repeat over and over again. You're playing the story that you set out to tell, you know? And but I don't believe it has to be like a cookie cutter. I can't work like that. I think you got to run with instinct once you've done all the work and you have a parameter to swing in. But if you start over layering it, you kind of miss, wait, what was your objective? What was your, the point of this moment, you know? Don't play the result, play the transition.
Yeah, I feel like that's one of the like benefits. Like we just did a film over here, right? It's one of the cool things about
this is like the prelude to the conversation. First of all, Crash, Lauren, welcome to the
house. Oh, yeah.
We'll keep all that in. I'm going to dive in because I had a supporter from my app or some to throw some questions in. And this one, I think, can be the whole premise of what we're going to talk about today.
Oh, cool.
But let's start with your names. Crash Buist.
Crash Buist, yes.
But give me the story behind the name Crash.
Oh, great. I was born Clarence Paul Buist IV. And like, that's too many of those.
What are you talking about? That's super posh. That sounds awesome.
Yeah, but I'm from Texas. Like, that's where I grew up in Texas. So it was like...
So say it again.
Clarence Paul Buist IV.
Did you have a ranch?
No, vineyard.
Of course you did.
Yeah, weird. So
vineyard in Texas?
Yeah, so my dad was a computer programmer in California, and he had his own business, and then moved to Vegas to do freelance stuff for casinos. Brilliant guy, and was doing really well, and then decided that his next venture was going to be moving us all to Central Texas to a town of 2,000 people from a 5,800 square foot like house in the suburbs of California in Las Vegas to a 800 square foot trailer house in the middle of nowhere. And it was interesting because like Texas has a grape scene kind of, and there's a whole thing about the soil and where it lands on like the Pangean Belt and stuff where like it's really rich, but the weather is a nightmare. So it was not the most successful venture ever. They say if you want to make a small fortune in agriculture, you should start with a large one.
Right.
And so that's what we ended up doing there, and it was cool. But
so is Texas known for its wine?
No, it is not. But they have some really good wine. There's some really good Texas wine. It's just...
So what was your... Who did you supply for, or did you have your own...
The vineyard was called Robert Clay Vineyards, and it was named after my brother and I. His name's Bobby, but Robert, and I was Clarence and Clay for short when I was younger, and then I changed it, being obnoxious.
So how did you...
Grade.
That's where you decided to be called Crash?
Yeah, yeah.
Be honest.
I was a weird kid. As a lot of it was just like me trying to get away with like, I have bad eyesight, and I don't know. I just like, I'd crash into things, and I think it was mostly just the Crash Bandicoot.
Thank you.
Character. Yeah, I think that's really the video game.
And are you legally called Crash now? Is it on...
No, it's just like business name stuff, but it still says Clarence on the...
But growing up, all your mates call you Crash?
Crash, yeah. Yeah.
When your dad calls you...
The Crash, yeah.
Really?
When grandma gave up and started calling me it, I was like, okay, I guess this is...
Did they ever say Clarence when you knew you were in trouble?
No, because it didn't... It was more... It's actually more... I think it was more accurate to yell Crash at the thing that's in trouble. It was... It made more sense to be Crash.
Awesome that they ran with it, too.
Yeah, they were really supportive.
And then we got Lauren Seneschal.
Yeah.
Seneschal?
Seneschal. I don't have a cool story behind my name.
You got a great last name, Seneschal.
Thank you.
It's melodic. I was going to say it's French. So it was both parents, were you born there? Were
born
in France, Canada.
No, on my mom's side, French family, Court matches her maiden name, and then my dad, last name was French, and his dad was Native American, so kind of weird combo.
Oh, very nice. Yeah. Well, that makes... Okay. So, I said we had a supporter write something in. And this will bring us into how we know each other, what we're doing here, what you're doing in England.
Great.
So this is from Chang Yi, I believe. I hope I'm not saying that incorrectly. I probably am, so I apologize. They say, hope you have a great podcast recording session. Would like to know, and I think this will really tie in well with what we're going to talk about, would like to know if the pandemic has affected the way they view or approach their creative pursuits, be it music, filmmaking, as compared to how you would have done things in the past. So, how we know each other?
Yeah.
You guys wrote, filmed, starred, produced in this new film venture called Echelon, which you cast me as William Wright, one of the characters, which we just shot here, all on green screen, here in London. You guys flew over for that. Mm-hmm. So rewind. Where were you, based on this question, before the pandemic started, what were you doing?
What were you doing before the pandemic?
I was in grad school. I had just started in Houston, Texas.
Houston, Texas, that's right.
University of Houston. I'd gotten there the year before, and we met doing Shakespeare Festival,
the Houston Shakespeare Festival.
And you were in L.A.
Previously. Jack Young, who runs the professional actor training program at the University of Houston, phenomenal school. One of the major perks being that they pay you to go to school there, which is a pretty good deal when it comes to graduate schools, because you do, you know, TA work and
right.
You teach classes and stuff. So, he knew me from, I was at school a few years back, and this was years previously, and she was coming into the program, and so we met doing that show. I played Mark Antony in Julius Caesar, and she was
Celia. As You Like It.
And that was where we met.
Yes, yeah. And he had moved to Houston the exact week before the pandemic hit, just by chance. It was
everything
his birthday.
Shut down on my birthday, so that was it's my fault. Everybody, it was March 12th.
Please blame you. Yes,
March 12th, 2020 was my 30th birthday.
Everyone, stay home and celebrate Crash's birthday. We'll see you in 2 years.
And I'd come back to Houston to shoot a feature. It was like my sort of my idea, because I was in LA before that, and just not like I had some interest in a couple of ideas and films from different people, and everybody's going to get your next thing done immediately all the time,
right?
And I started to realize that was not true. That like at a certain point you have to, especially if you have the capability, and I'd spent a lot of time learning lots of different stuff about the industry, post production, editing, sound. I was a boom guy forever, like. On sets and just had done every job. And I was like, why am I not doing every job? And the answer is because it takes a tremendous amount of capital to actually have the tools, time, resources to do all the jobs. You don't just go out there and make your film. But in Houston, I had known a lot of people that had property and friends and family where I was like, well, I could shoot a thing over here with the equipment that I have. And I could do this, and I could cast friends from school, and I could cast like teachers and Lauren's there, and we could work on something together. And like thinking that it was going to be legitimate, full-fledged production, that I was going to like do
this
a production.
This is all prior to pandemic.
Prior to the pandemic. And then as soon as it hit, it was like, oh, well, none of that's going to happen.
Yeah.
Like, I can't work with any of the actors I want to work with. I can't get my friend, I can't get Thomas to shoot this thing because nobody's seen each other and nobody's... And she got stranded away from school.
Yeah, I couldn't. All of the shows that we had planned were shut down. Everything went on to Zoom, which was an absolute nightmare. Doing theater school over Zoom is just the most stupid thing you could ever imagine.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a devil's advocate here. Going, they were trying. I will say that they did a fantastic job.
But the truth. You have to sit like that.
I'm probably the only one of the three of us, though, that didn't do any of it. Like, I remember my first Zoom production was like a year and a half after the pandemic started. I like finally did a Zoom thing, and I was like, "Oh, this is why."
I was
wants
just
to do
laughing
this.
At him the whole time off stage because he.
I didn't
just
mute.
Was like,
I was unmuted for like 2 minutes. You know, I did the whole thing. But I was like, "Don't you know this by now?"
So hang on, because I'm interested. So you guys are trained as actors.
Mm-hmm.
So you decided you wanted to start writing as well? You just had a knack for that, or a drive, or a fire for that?
Yeah, when I was in undergraduate training at Texas Tech University. It was a much better theater school than it was when I went there. It was no audition program, and some of the best actors I ever worked with were there, but it was a lot of not. And so I wasn't getting cast in things for whatever reason. Maybe I wasn't as good as I thought I was or whatever, but I started deciding that, well, I was going to do work anyway, and I started a theater company when I was 20. There, and it was like, we're gonna do a show in an old abandoned fire station, and we're gonna go over here and do some found space stuff. And so I started writing at least one act at that point, and continued writing until grad school, when I started working on Shakespeare and Ibsen and Williams and all the things that we started working on there. And then I discovered that, oh god, I'm not as good of a writer as I thought, and maybe I should just stick to saying words instead of writing them. And then it took a long time to get back into it, but then started writing screenplays in LA and that kind of thing, and then
screenplays for you, or you were being commissioned?
All for me. Yeah, it was all
with the idea selfish, of like, yeah, I'm gonna write a great film, kind of like Chaz Palminteri writing The Bronx Tale. He's like, I'm gonna write.
Yeah, I mean, so sometimes it's show business, right? So once you start to realize that it's not just about plays and art, you're like, oh, I actually need to like eat, or I need to get my SAG card or whatever. Like one of the first things I actually wrote and produced my short film was purely to make it a SAG, Screen Actors Guild picture, so I could maybe get eligible to join the union. And you have to like have something produced. And so it was the same muscle again, going like, well, if I'm going to get stuff done, I got to write it for me, and it needs to not be bad, and it needs to get done and work with people that are in the union. So yeah, so all for me, pretty much. It's like, I like to write things for me to be. And then when I met this tremendous, talented artist, and I moved to Houston, I was like, well, we need to do something together. We need to do something that features her. Not knowing that she's one of the most gifted writers too that I'd ever met. And you did this in a lot of the same stuff, right? In undergrad with writing with
Teague
and everything. You guys had a...
Yeah, mostly wrote scripts for stage, things like that, doing short competitions and working on a full-length one, but never anything for screen before.
So, and you were doing that as part of like, this is what we do as actors. We want to be on stage, you want to write. You had a passion for that.
Well, my best friend in college was really, really talented at writing and kind of got me into it, because just watching him figure out how to put things together and creating stories, and I was like, I think I can do that, because I've been reading and enjoying plays for so long. I was like, I think I have some ideas for it, and kind of crafting things together was challenging, but it was really, really fun. Something that was, you know, you wait around so much to get cast in things, and it's all relying on other people to put you into art. And so it's like, okay, you start pushing the box on other things that you can do for yourself, and how do you expand and how do you keep creating when you're not on stage? So
that's a good point. So you realize that basically you got to go after what you want, and it's not necessarily going to be handed to you or be served up for you. So that brings us to wait, go on. You're going to say something?
Yes. And also, like, when you do get handed something, it's inevitably garbage. So
his philosophy, right?
It's really it.
But you
man.
Handed like, me this film.
Yeah, right, yes, exactly. So,
but you made it. You so try to be garbage, like,
well,
right?
if the garbage is the levels here, then, like, you know, your grad school, I was saying, like, you see all this Shakespeare and the Shaw, and you're like, wow, this is what rewriting is. And then you go to LA, and your first short film project, you know, at USC or whatever, or wherever, is like, oh no, this is the level of thing. Oh, and then you watch something on Netflix and you're like, man, it would be so great to be in that.
Yeah.
Because then you get paid and da-da-da. But then you're like, okay, well, as long as I have a laptop, I could write something better than that. Why don't you, you know? Or at least learn that you can't, and then learn how to do that. Mm-hmm. Anyway.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at OutsidersMusical.com.
So then that brings us to the pandemic. Everything shuts down, and now you think, oh shit, what are we going to do with our time?
Yeah.
What are we going to do with our life? Like, you just got there. So where were you living at this point?
So I was living in a house in the Heights in Houston. We'd sort of been squatting in what ended up becoming a set later. It was like an abandoned recording studio that, like, we were hanging out in that has like an upstairs area. And we were kind of hanging out there most of the time. Lauren was still living. You were still living with your roommates, right, mm-hmm. at that point.
Yeah.
And that was where we sort of like hunkered down in quarantine. And Yeah, so the entire, all the scripts that I had about three features in the backpack that I was like, we could do one of these, were impossible suddenly. So we mostly played video games for like...
For a while.
Yeah, for like a
long
time.
Are you a gamer too, Laura?
Yeah, definitely getting into it more with him.
That's what are you playing?
Well, we played through Dead Space and Dead Space 2 all...
Very scary.
And what platforms is on?
That was on PC for that one, yeah. Right? Yeah, because I had like sort
is
of...
Is that the right terminology too? Platform?
Platform, yeah. Yeah, that's... You damn it.
That's great. That was a close one.
Yeah. Atari?
Are you...
It's on the Xbox?
The SNES?
Are you on that Xbox?
The Super SNES? Yeah.
So you're gamers, passing time. Mm-hmm. And where's Echelon at this point?
It's nothing. Yeah, it was... you should tell that one, because...
We didn't... Really, I mean, we were trying to figure out projects to do. We did a short film for...
Oh, my God.
We did a... forgot about that. We did a short film for a competition, because everyone was like, well, you need something that has to do with the pandemic, and we were just bored and looking for something to do.
It was one-minute short films, and, like, In By Yourself or whatever, like...
Yeah.
And it was a thing about... It's called Delivery that we did, and we won a couple competitions with it, where I was just a delivery dude who showed up to the house, and she was, the premise was that you were speed dating.
I was just, my character is in quarantine, and she's going to different delivery apps, and then, like, trying to flirt with all the delivery boys, but she's just going through them.
Yeah, because you can't meet anybody, so she was just, like, ordering food, and then trying to seduce,
like,
whoever
shows up. She has, like, wine on the porch,
and... Who wrote this?
We did. We actually just sat down, we're like, we need to be done in 3 days, so what do we do? And we wrote it, edited it.
We painted our front room for it, and then we like set up curtains and tried to make it look nice for
frame. Did a whole production design.
And this is during pandemic now.
Yeah, this was like, this is our first thing in the pandemic.
Yeah.
And that was fun. And then, so my
ass was
like.
What'd you shoot that on?
That was shot.
Did you have all the gear at this point?
He had a bunch of gear from when he was working in LA, trying to create some short film stuff there.
So were you buying up gear over time, thinking, I know
I was trying to start some semblance of a production company in LA, and I wasn't sure what I wanted to do, but I knew that, like, I wanted to do stuff for, like, I was shooting reel for friends, like, actors that didn't have a lot of film stuff. I knew that that was important, and that I could get my reps, like, messing up exposure and ruining, well, Brian's stuff might be terrible, but, like, at least, you know.
It
was free, you know. And then, and that's where I started, like, learning that the camera stuff, but I had Blackmagic Pocket Cinema 4K camera is, like, it's like a $1,300 camera, which is like a lot of money.
You just geeked out on me. Was that the name of the camera?
That's the name of the camera.
Okay.
It's a terrible name. It's the worst thing.
What happened?
Blackmagic is the worst name of a camera.
So what's that is the actual name of a camera?
Of a camera, yeah. And it's just like a chunky looks kind of like a regular stills camera. But then you hook everything up to it and make it look professional. But we didn't have any of that. So with that, we ended up shooting a thing for the short film. Mm-hmm. And then I said, well, I mean, it's a minute. Long thing took us 2 days. Well, then surely like 100 minutes. Let's just do a feature.
Well, nobody can actually do that math, but it should be that long, right? That's an impossible equation.
Yeah, I was like, yeah, it'll be 100 times more time, and that's it. I said, no, that's not. It was much more difficult than I thought, but that was the idea. It's like, well, we shot a whole thing, just the two of us.
So let's just shoot a whole feature together. Film.
Of course you can.
Absolutely.
Of course you can.
And then I think to answer the question, like, yeah, like the. How does it influence the pandemic influence what you're doing? Is like, it limits you. And I think one of the coolest things that I've learned over the course of my life with lots of limits and limitations and being incredibly privileged enough to act on things, like I feel like, oh yeah, you have a video camera, dude. And you have like some cheap lights. I had a friend that I did theater with named Chip who like sold me all of his old lights for nothing because he was like old tungstens that were falling apart and stuff because he was just like, I don't want to do this anymore. I hate production. I just want to do acting. Take my things. It's like, how lucky that I had like all these old beat up lights and stuff. But then you have this limitation of like, it's only the two of you. And suddenly all of your ideas have to fit within this.
Where's all
framework.
Your gear at this point now? You got all these tungstens.
It was
lights.
All up in that. In another old abandoned building at that point. So, which was part of the thing is like our limit is we only have two people, but the luck of it is we have these empty buildings that nobody's using because nothing's going on right now.
So where does Echelon start?
Well, we had a couple of your friends in LA sent us that there was a competition going on for just a script that if you could write a script where people are socially distanced and the story worked and everything, then you would win and they would produce and get a director on board and do the entire thing. So we're like, that sounds fantastic. We should just write a script and send that in and we can start working and see, you know, what would come of that.
Heidi Hornbacher, some great writer that I met in LA that was actually very good at writing certain projects and it wasn't garbage.
Right.
And she was like, you should do this. And then, so we
did it and we sat down and we wrote the script and just before we sent it off, we read the fine print. And essentially, if you sent it in, you lost all rights to it. You would have no hold on
it. Regardless of whether you won the competition,
it was no longer yours. They reserved
the rights to use your script for, you know, in perpetuity.
Whoa.
For the rest of time.
And after writing it, we got so attached to it. And we're like, we really like this idea. It's really cool. We want to do it.
Yeah,
I bet they were connected
to Warner Brothers. We need some more scripts. Just do this, and we'll just keep everything that comes in.
For real.
Exactly, yeah. And it was, you know, they're not producing the good ones, and they're just keeping them or whatever. You know, I'm sure not. I'm sure it was all legitimate and whatever. And they were putting in, the contest wasn't just that you, like, did your film with them. It was they gave you $50,000, which sounds like a lot of money, especially when you have no money, as we did not. Mm-hmm. But when you start to put it all together, $50,000 is like, does not go a long way.
Not in film, no.
But the way we had written it, it would have gone a long way because it was just the two of us and like locations that we had. And
so you've got the script, you like it, and you don't want to hand it over.
Mm-hmm. No.
So then what?
Then you had to build a spaceship then.
So you decided we want to build this. We want to do this film ourselves.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So at this point you think, I've got tungsten lights. I've got this.
Yeah, I've got all these old honky lights and stuff, and we got and we'd won a competition with the short film, and we'd won like a little.
And they
like,
sent us lights, so we're like, "Wow,
the single worst LED light I've ever
that
used."
Fell apart every time we used it.
It still works, though. I don't even know the brand, but it was like one of those off-brand lights where you're like, "Surely this will fall apart."
So excited. We're like, "We're professionals now."
It's like my first LED light. They're like, "Oh man!" It plugs in, and like it has a little knob that like turns on, and then it's got all the like different effects and stuff, and you just have to turn this little knob, which means every time you touch it with your hand, it starts
suddenly
strobing.
You're in a thunderstorm, and you're it's a nightmare.
But it was
So you decided to we're gonna shoot ourselves. So you're gonna build a spaceship.
Mm-hmm. So the premise of the film is called Echelon, right? But the idea is it's Space Rapunzel. If in 2057, I should know the year that my film
I think place. 2057, isn't it?
2057, that's right, yeah. And then what if, like, a future Jeff Bezos / Elon Musk / whatever, who has sort of full control over, like, the corporate world and governments and everything, lived in a space station and kept his daughter that no one knows about in a separate ancillary pod space station thing that like nobody knows about, and some hacker, the sort of Flynn Rider character, discovers her, but when he's hacking into the stuff for an organization that wants to pay him a bunch of money, so set up the whole thing where nobody had to be next to each other, everybody could be, you know, and put it in a post-pandemic world, also not this pandemic but like a fictional pandemic that was far more deadly and dangerous, and to emphasize the social distancing, all the things we were dealing with and thinking about at the time. And your question was, we decided to shoot a space station, spaceship. Yeah, right. So she's in a spaceship. So we're like, well, that, you know, it won't be hard. We'll just make
one of the buildings that we had access to in the basement was an empty, like, recording studio for a band. And so it was kind of perfect because we could just go in and we got some flats and built, you know.
Flats. Garbage. We found a bunch of garbage.
We put posts on Craigslist for styrofoam and things like that, and the entire set is just styrofoam that we either literally were diving in dumpsters for or we're picking up at people's doorsteps around Houston because people were like, we have that.
Yeah, it was, you know, not having a mask on and not meeting anybody, but, still social distancing, but just going to get
styrofoam. I'm not worried about that. I'm garbage. Like, you're actually going and picking up garbage.
Oh, yeah.
To build your set.
Yeah, because we had no money, so we figured, you know.
Yeah.
And we had looked at, like, how people had built old, you know, sets for films and things, and a lot of it was. Like, unique styles on the wall, and how do you make it look sci-fi?
There's a super awesome anecdote about Star Wars that somebody was talking about props and stuff. And this set me down a path of, like, I look for anything where I'm like, anything that gives me an excuse to do whatever I want. And then I just kind of like look at that. Oh, okay, good. That's my excuse that I'm allowed to do whatever I want.
Right.
And the Star Wars anecdote being that like the lightsaber, like one of the most iconic science fiction props of all time, is an old flashbulb holder for like a manual camera, like one of those explodes and the bulb explodes, right? Just some old piece of garbage that they had on set. And windshield wipers that they just glued to the handle of it. And that's how you get a thing that a beam comes out of and the cool black like handle. That's it. Like some intern was just hungover, forgot to do it, and was just like, oh God, I gotta go sort a laser sword. I gotta bring the laser sword to set that. And now it's like they sell them for $300 at Disneyland.
Amazing.
And so it was like that kind of idea. It's like, well, if it looks good.
Yeah, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Same thing I was listening to like Ridley Scott talk about, because he was a production designer and did on Alien, yeah. And everybody knows from Alien, but he spent, and like Blade Runner and all these things, but he'd spent years doing commercials and doing production design. And he was just like, I remember he's had this anecdote about being on set for Blade Runner. Somebody was like, well, I've got this big box, but like I need a big giant prop for over here. I need like a big machine for this. And he's like, just take that, turn it upside down. And they're like, you can't do that. And the production guy's like arguing with him. He's like, I'm the director, just do what I say. But also like, no one will notice.
Amazing.
Yeah. And so it was that idea of going like, well, I'll just cheat until it looks good. And so it was like paint the styrofoam with old paint we had in the garage until it looks decent.
We were passable. Not, yeah, couldn't breathe in the room.
Yeah. Until you had to go spend money on like LED lights and stuff to like
make ordering things off Amazon and thrifting things at Goodwill and just whatever you could put together.
The set took 3.5 months to build. Yeah. So.
Really? So yeah. In that time, are you just filming anything or building?
Just building, working. And I was getting ready for my second year of grad school, and you were also building the space pod.
The escape pod, the actual space station. There was another set that was like.
And I was doing costumes.
Yeah, she's building costumes and going to grad school full time.
So where's this, all these sets like living day to day? That
in the abandoned recording studio that's like right next to. That so has you, that
were you squatting there? You were serious when you said you were squatting
there? No. We know the people that own it, and they were going to tear it down. So we had this time where we're like, okay, this is to be done.
So they're like, yeah, build it, keep it there.
Yeah, they're going to tear it down anyway.
We're not tearing it down until such and such date.
Yeah.
Because everything stopped because of COVID. So they were going to have someone buy the property and do the whole thing, and they didn't have to worry about it for a while. So they were like, go for it. Just, you know,
you got about 6 months.
Have a deadline, but go
and
for it.
And we ended up being, everything got pushed, everything, which was great because every time you'd be like, well, that the guy would be like, that deal fell through, but we can't rent it because nobody's renting out a recording studio right now. Like it was an interesting case of like all the terrible things that come with COVID were like our saving graces as far as like, well, if nobody's going to use this space. We shot an entire segment of the film in the Brown Theater in Houston, which
the
is like
opera house the in opera Houston house. Because no one was going in there for anything. There's no shows going on. So we were able to rent it out for a day for a rehearsal rate. They were like, please, we need any money that we can because we can't get anybody in here. And so we had
the
entire
subtext,
theater.
But they were still
that
like,
was, yeah.
Well, we'll let you come in.
We'll allow you.
Incredible people.
But we had the whole theater to ourselves for a day of filming. And we ran around and, yeah, it was a lot of work, but it was gorgeous.
But it would never happen.
Never.
Know, if the ballet was in there and
we couldn't afford it.
Well, what's been going through my head as you're talking now, it goes back to Chang Yi's question.
Mm-hmm.
I'm almost thinking now, if it wasn't for the pandemic, maybe you couldn't have even done this film.
Wouldn't have happened, wouldn't look as good.
Yeah.
Because one, the rates would have been different. Business would be as normal. So mm-hmm. if you didn't have the funds, which you didn't.
No, yeah.
And we wouldn't have had the time.
Maybe that
wouldn't have had the
warehouse
time
would have been yeah. demolished earlier.
State of California is going to hate to hear this, but like I spent all of the all of the money that they were like the unemployment money. Because I had done jobs like off jobs and like... whatever, like just a voiceover gig here and there and all this stuff, money, making money in California and like my, like driving for Lyft or whatever.
You do have a good voice. Like, are you not doing audible books? I want to hear you.
You did voiceover.
I did a lot of like redubbing for Russian features and stuff. So I was really good at the, I was trying to think of which country it was. It was not Spanish, very fast, like where anything that was Spanish or Italian ones would be really good because there's a lot of really fast words and like speaking, then I could like cram a bunch of English words in it really quickly so it looked like it was somebody actually speaking that fast, so they'd call me in for those. But it was, that stuff was fun. And it's hard. You've done some of that, like dubbing or anything? Have you ever done any?
No. Only on my own stuff, like ADR stuff.
ADR, sure.
With Hobie.
But that's nigh impossible, right? Like you're like, I don't know, I did this. Now I'm trying to like make it sound believable.
And like, I go, maybe walk towards the mic. Walk. I'm like, why didn't we just do this on the day?
We had to do a lot of that. We had to.
So much.
So much.
Because we, at one point, we filmed in a art studio that...
just kids screaming. Just,
yeah, like, there was like a gymnastics.
This was a little later thing. In the pandemic when they'd started like doing... Because we shot over... It took like a year and...
Yeah, we thought it was going to be a couple, maybe a couple months of filming, and it turned out to be way longer.
Yeah. 13 locations we ended up like sourcing and then like prepping and then building, and then we'd go in there and shoot that section and then we'd be done.
And we'd be up at dawn doing things, or we'd be out at 3 o'clock in the morning filming shots for...
But that leads us to the start. Now, which where we got to
work. Well, I was going to ask, how many is in the cast of this film?
Four major characters.
Yeah.
We might be reshooting a scene.
And adding
in which case we'll have like a fifth in-person character.
Yeah.
Maybe.
And you shot, so like your counterpart, Edgar?
Jonathan Medina, who is...
So he would shoot his scenes on his own?
In Los Angeles on green screen over Zoom. And I would direct him and he would shoot it on like a Canon... $600-$700 camera that he like had that he used for like self tapes and stuff, and then he would shoot it on a green screen and I'd be like, okay, more light on that side of the green screen, and I'd help him like set it up, and then we'd act, and then he'd send me the raw files and I would comp those into conversations I would have with him, where we have three or four scenes together where I like call him on a holopad that I end up doing on post production. I did like visual effects for it, but I'd call him on this beautiful piece of equipment that she designed and built for the film. And which was, again, like garbage, like an MMA glove that you cut up and but yeah, so he did that from afar. And I think we had a couple other people do some green screen stuff and send it in as well.
Cause
yeah,
there was
a commercial
point.
For
the commercial,
a lot of them are my classmates from my graduate program. I was like, do you guys want to come in and film for this? Cause we just need someone to be like, and that's doing it right. And so they were just my classmates. And we have one of my professors from the university is there for a brief time. And yeah, just anybody we could.
And what's amazing is you guys said to me on set that prior to starting Echelon, you barely even touched a camera.
Yeah, no.
And now you know all about lighting, camera work, sound. You were doing sound on one point, focus pulling on another point.
Yeah.
This is all learning on the job.
Yeah, absolutely. I didn't have any interest in doing anything with film or television, and I just wanted to do stage. And then I met this wonderful filmmaker who had spent 5 years learning absolutely anything and everything he could. And then, yeah, we wanted to do a project. We wanted to keep working on things and have something to show when we got out of the pandemic. And so I was like, okay, I guess I'm doing this. And so he's rigging me up with all of the camera stuff, and I'm learning it, and I messed up so many things. But
no, she
did.
By the end of, like, day six, she was pulling focus better than me and, like, was getting everything right all the time. It's, in addition to being handily one of the, if not the most talented actor that I've ever met, it's just... As you know, about acting or any sort of thing, it's like, how much attention can I put on, like, not myself? Not worrying about, like, whether I'm good enough or looking good enough. It's like, no, this is the thing needs to be good. Mm-hmm. I need to make sure it looks good and then be smart and talented, I guess. And then, so she'd just pick up everything. And it wouldn't have been done without her. Or it would have just been some, like, home movie project or whatever. But yeah.
I enjoyed it. It was a really huge challenge. It was something I'd never done. And he was so incredibly helpful teaching me and being like, no, you got to do this instead of this. And you pick up on it pretty quickly when you're doing it every single day and spending hours.
I was blown away at how seamless you guys would make this work. Like, 1 minute you'd be on sound and you're on sound. At one point, we're acting in our scene together. So you're doing sound, slates, focus pull, camera, action.
Yeah.
Camera work. I'm like, this is incredible. The tenacity to think, okay.
Well, we were lucky because we had somebody else besides ourselves to shoot when you were there. So there's three of us instead of just two.
Yeah, because usually if we were filming in like the theater or something, you have to have someone on camera to see how does the light look. You have to have someone standing in. So if it was a shot he had to be in, then I had to like check everything around him. If it was, you know, so it was
Like any shot that everything. I am, she's shooting it. Anytime she's in a shot, I'm shooting it. And then anytime it's both of us in a shot, which is like a lot of our film takes place in like a virtual reality world where our two characters are interacting. And there's like nobody else around. And it's just, which is because it's in this world where why would there not only be the two of us? It's like, yeah. Oh, because it's her own private virtual reality simulation. Then we'd have to set the thing up on a tripod and set it up on sticks
and walk in a frame
and be like, get the thing with the cable going to it so we could like see how it looks and like make sure the lights look good. There's Bo Burnham's Inside is a really great example of watching somebody try to like
put everything together
all by themselves, and he's brilliant. Bo Burnham.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you see his special?
I haven't.
Oh my God, dude. He's just alone. Same thing.
It's so good.
But he's very much emphasizing the fact that he's doing it alone all by himself, so you get to watch him like see how the light makes him look, like, and then like move his face. And,
yeah, we have a lot of ETS footage of us with like, he's in frame and I'm like pushing a dolly and then I'm adjusting the focus and making sure it's not falling off. And then I'm adjusting my dress and walking into frame to act with him. And then I'm like, okay, I have to back up and do it again because that didn't look good.
Yeah, and repeating that. There's a great shot of me thinking that like I could do we have this easy rig at one point because we were like going to break our necks. So it's just
so
like
much stupid.
It's just like a stick that holds it. Camera that like you can do this, and I've got this thing on and I've got my jacket on.
I've seen those.
Yeah, and I'm like trying to make it look like I'm in the shot, but you can't see the easy rig.
He was convinced that he could take his full rig and make it look like a selfie, essentially.
No way.
And like I could move it and be like, I wanted this shot where like I would like look at the thing and then she'd be behind me and she'd say a word and it would like discover her behind me. It's the dumbest shot. You're like, it's not gonna work. And you gotta like,
it was like midnight in the theater and he's like, no, I can make this work. I can do this.
Did you?
No.
Oh, God,
no.
Yeah. There's so many of those, though. So many moments where you're like,
that didn't work. Okay.
I will try this because I must, because it's the pandemic and nobody's here to do it for me. So
I'm so inspired by this because, again, it's like, you know, I have my 8X community. The whole point of that is like being your best self, being better than yesterday, you know, striving to grow.
Mm-hmm.
You guys... What is it? Do you take lemons and make lemonades? You guys made a feast. Like, this is unbelievable.
Thank you.
Look, regardless of the finished product, but I think with what the setup was, even on the day we were on the green screen studio. Mm-hmm.
Well, you got a chance to see a little bit of it, too.
Yeah, it's incredible. I was like, when you sent me that scene,
mm-hmm.
that's when I said to my manager, I was like, I got to be part of this. Like, how are they even doing this? What a learning experience, let alone what a great experience. And as it turns out, we've become mates.
Yeah.
In a very short space of time. But there's so much I want to learn from you guys. And I'm hoping that people, when they listen to this, whether they're filmmakers or not, the takeaway is you can do whatever you want if you put your mind to it. You're willing to go through garbage.
Yeah, oh yeah.
To make some...
make a lot of garbage.
Make art out of a lot of that garbage, you know?
Yeah.
I'm blown away. It's amazing.
Well, but you
someone who has a podcast and a band and someone who has been doing theater and you are a person who goes out and does
I'm
that.
I'm surrounded by amazing people, amazing team, my band are amazing.
Absolutely.
I just show up. You guys are doing this all yourself.
There's so many people. I mean, like, this is another thing. Like, where do I get permission? It's like, well, fuck, I can do it then if that person's not doing it or this garbage is on this thing. It's like, how many people do you know? Just that you don't, clearly don't name any names, but like, how many people have the money, the resources, the time, they could call whoever they wanted to? They're just not.
Lazy.
Or just there's no need. Mm. They got it already. They're already doing the time. I have a friend, Jonathan Medina, who's in the film, who's on The Purge and a bunch of other things. He's so hungry to do more stuff. He just did a Disney Plus show. I don't know if I'm allowed to say that. But he has so many friends that have been doing the business in LA as actors for years and years, and they're successful and they have like a clout and money and they're able to like have whole projects start and they just don't do it. And then they end up being like, they're like 55 going like, I should start producing. And it's like, yeah. And you should, but then
what else?
And it's never too late to start, but like, why weren't you doing it when you had that 2 years off when you were not doing anything? Why were you not interested? Cause I don't know. And then I don't want to be judgmental either because, I don't know, some people just don't...
aren't wired like that.
Yeah, so it's not that what they want. It's not that it's not their passion, you know?
But the takeaway is, I guess, stay hungry.
If you want to eat, yeah.
yeah. Which you are. You're doing it, man.
Oh, man, it's going to be fun.
You both have done incredible things in such, again, a short space of time, you know?
So what's the plan? When are we hoping to see this film?
So we have to go shoot.
We want to redo a reshoot of the middle scene or middle act there.
Yeah, and then we're gonna try and get there's a lot of post production that's already done because I learned visual effects and started doing that, and that took 7 months or so of just like going, I don't know, but it's mostly a finished film, and that's one of the perks of doing it this way, is like we're plugging you into it and then changing things around your performance, which brought so much to it. So it should be a few months, and then we're gonna like shop it around to different distribution companies, and that's its own freaking nightmare. And,
yeah, I bet.
Maybe we'll just put it out there, and whoever wants to buy it or rent it can just do that.
Well, I'm sure we're gonna see it, and we'll I'll help as much as I can. Oh. But I really appreciate you guys first being on The Hang and having me in your film Echelon. Oh. I've learned so much watching you both. You guys. And how you work as a team so seamlessly through a pandemic, as a couple, still together. That's unbelievable. Not once did you argue on the day on the set, too. And with creatives, there's always an argument. There was none of that.
No arguments ever, not once.
You guys balance each other out.
On the set with him, no.
Oh, did you guys argue?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so you are human.
Yes. It's hard.
She's got the patience of just... a goddess.
Well, the respect you guys have for each other was so clear on that day, and it's like when you got stressed, you knew how to balance that ball, and then vice versa. And I was like, this dance is beautiful.
Thank you, man.
Listen,
you're easy to work with, so it wasn't like there was any problem.
It was freezing cold.
Oh my god,
it was very
cold. It was fun though. Usually, I ask this question, and I've never had two at once. So, very quickly.
Sorry.
What made you smile yesterday?
He made me smile yesterday.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
What made you smile yesterday?
Oh, man.
How
are you going to answer now?
I mean, like, yeah.
How would you have answered?
She made me smile yesterday, every day, every single day.
First childhood memory that comes to your mind, Lauren?
Walking with my grandpa and when I was very young and telling him I loved him more than squirrels.
Oh.
Yeah.
It's not fair. I get to think longer than she does. You put her on the
spot.
Yeah,
but that's quite the answer. So
it's pretty good. It's terrible because it's childhood walking. I remember like being a kid and like looking up at this long path, and just being like, "That's scary." So I kind of want to go up there.
Is that your childhood memory? You're looking at that
like,
hill
I was
now?
Like on a walk in like Walnut Creek, California, where I was born. And I don't remember if I was walking with my mom or what, but it's just like looking up a.
That's scary.
Like a weird like a driveway for. You know, when you're a kid, everything is like huge. This is just like this.
Carry
this
me.
Terrifying.
No, you're 6'8". I'm not going to take you.
Yeah.
As a toddler, yes.
Yeah.
I
guess smaller. How can my incredible supporters support you guys? How they look out for what you're doing?
We have our Instagram and Facebook, Stenic Studios.
Stenic Studios?
You can follow us there.
Stenic Studios. Our Instagrams.
Lauren
_ Seneschal and at Crash Buist.
And where can we watch that? I want to see that 1 minute short film you did with the delivery people.
That'll be up on Stenic.
Yeah, well, we're going to post that on the
Instagram. Website. Soon. Yes, Instagram.
Great. And if you want me to push that on my app, I'll put that on there for you guys as well.
We'll send you a sort of a medium quality version of the film.
Send a high quality.
Because there's no good internet in London, it turns out. I've been trying to upload. Oh my god, everything is just put together with like garbage can lids and copper wire here.
Yeah.
It's not a...
But we make do.
Yeah.
Alright guys, all the best. Thanks for hanging.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much, man.
You've been listening to The Hang. I am Ramin Karimloo. The Hang is produced by Mercy Productions and Desert Highway and recorded at Soho Live Studios. Check out my new app. Go to ramin.fan.direct where you can find brand new content, giveaways, and exclusive news. Thanks for listening.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Suffs has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suffsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but yeah. Not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.